Are you familiar with that term defamiliarization? You know, to become unfamiliar with the things that are already familiar, or to have everyday commonplace kinds of things turned into like a problem in a new way. That's what I'm trying to do with the texts for this lecture. These are Rob Johnson's The People's Republic of Neverland and Emmanuel Wallerstein's Introduction to World Systems Analysis. They're here to defamiliarize schooling, to defamiliarize the setting where you've been for so long already, and to cause you to think about a couple of things as contingent, meaning as susceptible to change, like they could be different, things that you're probably accustomed to thinking of as just given and unchangeable. So I will acknowledge that these are two kind of oddball texts, especially to have together, and it might take a moment to see especially how the Wallerstein fits in here. So just a pause to talk about the texts for a second. I really don't know much about Rob Johnson. I don't know who he is. I just happened to come across this text, and I saw that these few pages included what I thought was a kind of useful little proto-history of mainstream compulsory schooling. So I simply want you to recognize that, you know, before 1820 in Prussia, there's no such things as schools. That's 200 years ago, right? Like this aspect of our lives that seems so concrete and so secured, so unchangeable, wasn't there 200 years ago, and it showed up in England and in the United States 50 years after that. You could also say that the other origin of schooling here is Napoleon's France, which I'll come back to. But anyway, the Rob Johnson text is just there to give that little history. And then the Emmanuel Wallerstein, this is a book that I totally recommend to everybody, Introduction to World Systems Analysis. But it feels a little bit weird here because we're not at all concerned with world systems analysis. So when you start reading that text, and you can see that it's giving its own history. It's trying to give you a history of the origins of world systems analysis, and yet we don't care about world systems analysis, so why does this history matter? Well, the answer is that the history matters because this history is the history of the disciplines, of how the different departments and subject focuses, which now organize academia and the university, came to be. So these are the things I simply want to draw your attention to, and then point out that, hey, there's problems with the disciplines. You know, world systems analysis, for one thing, is a very interesting intellectual tendency of the last 30, 40 years, which, for one thing, is attempting to bridge differences between disciplines, trying to draw from multiple disciplines at once, trying to be multi and interdisciplinary. Because for those of us who have lived inside these structures for a long time, and we're really trying to think, and we're really trying to understand the overall system of which we're a part, so that we can understand what would be good for us to do and how we could do it, disciplines get in our way. I bet disciplines get in your way, but I don't know if you ever thought about how. So that's what I'm encouraging you to do. Okay, so just content from the Johnson text. Pretty quick. Compulsory education, he says, was refined in Prussia in the 1820s. That's where the modern schooling system, as we now have it, really gets its origin. But you could step back another 10, 20 years and look at revolutionary France. I just want to draw your attention to this for a moment, that the modern nation state, the form of social political organization, which corresponds with the economic organization of capitalism, the nation state with which we are so familiar, which seems so normal and normalized, with its flags and its armies and its borders and its uniform languages and cultures, that also is only 200 years old. That's new in the history of the world. Even in 1800, most French people would not have called themselves French. That identity had not yet really been formed. They would have identified in terms of their regions, maybe in terms of their religion. And they would even have spoken, they did speak different dialects, which didn't sound like the same language if you got far enough apart from one another. You know, France as a nation of French speakers with a unified culture involving crepes and soccer, it's all new. Things that seem invariant historically, they seem that way just because we are already in them and because we're told a whole bunch of stories that lead us to believe that they are eternal, but they are not. And so if we want to start asking which among these structures and institutions are good for us, we got to get that idea that some are eternal and inescapable out of the way. So one detail that Johnson gives us, what I was going to say about France was that Napoleon, once he took power, so the French Revolution, you know, involves the terror, it involves uprisings in 1787, eventually the terror by 1790, you know, cutting off the heads of tons of aristocratic people and priests. And then the Directorate, that's the end of the terror and a kind of move back in a maybe conservative direction by 1791. And then the takeover by Napoleon by the end of the 1790s. So by 1800, we have this new France, which is becoming the model for nation states all over Europe. And this new France is homogenizing everybody. It's putting everybody together into systems. It's building police like has never been seen in the history of the world. And it is, at the same time that it's proliferating police functions, it's proliferating schooling. Napoleon intentionally sets up the first uniform educational system in the world, the purpose of which is to produce French citizens who have French patriotic ideas, who have a French identity, who speak a shared French, which not coincidentally makes them open to communication with and inspection by central authorities. If everybody's speaking a different language, it's really hard to monitor them. If they're all speaking the same language, it's a lot easier. So schooling, along with policing and prison, serves this function of homogenizing and making more controllable the society. Schooling shows up there. And then in Germany, early 1800s, Prussia is also a highly militaristic and highly state society. Schooling is performing the same role there. It's making uniform and it's producing useful subjects for this new social, political, and economic capitalist endeavor. So Johnson tells us that compulsory education makes its way to England, and it shows up in the United States around this, you know, latter half of the 1800s, in 1870. And he makes an interesting passing point, which is that it's not just instantiated out of nowhere. They set up in England compulsory education, mainstream education, where all the kids are required to go. They're gonna all salute the flag, and they're gonna all learn to brush their teeth, and they're all gonna learn to be on time and shut up and respect the boss, right? They institute that institution because working class organizations had already started setting up places for education. They were taking control of that function of social reproduction. Labor organizations in particular were setting up situations where kids could go and learn stuff and learn skills and learn beliefs and learn attitudes. But these were the wrong beliefs and the wrong attitudes from the perspective of the owners and the government. So they set up mainstream schooling in England to offset and to overwhelm these working class initiatives. You know, there's always been opposition to mainstream schooling. In this case, even before mainstream schooling exists, there's opposition to it. Remember, we were just reading Dewey Dewey was writing from the late 1800s to 1940 or so. So in that period, that's when the alternative schools show up. Johnson mentions the modern schools or fairer schools, something we'll read later and read about later in the semester. That began around 1910. So there's really never been mainstream schooling without a really serious antagonism to mainstream schooling. And from the very beginning, there has been an awareness that mainstream schooling is supposed to serve the interests of the elite and the powerful who are already within the society, supposed to perpetuate the society as it exists as a class and pyramid-shaped society. And alternative education has been in the hands of and trying to serve the interests of the working classes, the people who are subjugated in this society. Okay, so just, you know, recognize that stuff. The school shows up about the same time as the factory, and the school's built on the model of the factory, and then the school is there to provide bodies for the factory. Okay, that said, then let's just move on to the other question, which is, did you ever think about how weird it is that in college we've got all these different disciplines, departments, subjects, and they're all supposed to be totally distinct, and yet what if they're not? The question we can ask is, where does all this sort of stuff come from? And when we get to Daniel Wildcat and Vine Deloria later, they're going to say, for example, that, you know, this way of understanding, which is typical of Western Europe, is actually totally contrary to the philosophy and epistemology, that means a theory about what knowledge is, of indigenous American peoples. The idea that you can break knowledge into parts, that you can only study like a part and then still be a knowledgeable and wise person, is contrary to an indigenous perspective. So the Wallerstein text is just there because it gives you this history. It was not always the case that the university existed. It was not always the case that the universities that did exist, which were basically monastic institutions showing up in the later Middle Ages, so we're talking from 1100 or 1200 up until the 1500s, 1600s, we have these universities. That's where the term shows up. These are meeting places for scholars who are largely monks from around Europe to meet. Interesting things happen in those universities, like especially the kind of cross pollination of Muslim, Jewish, and Christian traditions. But for our purposes, the point is simply those universities didn't yet have the disciplinary structure that ours has, but we can start there in order to tell the story of how that disciplinary structure shows up. Disciplinary structure, again, I just mean there being different subjects, physics versus mathematics versus English versus Spanish versus history. So the medieval university, Wallerstein tells us, had four faculties: theology, medicine, law, and philosophy. And at that time, philosophy meant everything that could be known in a systematic way. Right? Law is the study of actual existing empirical law. Medicine is the study of how do you heal bodies. And of course, there's even like dark stuff going on about this stuff, right? Because in this period of time, especially leading up from 1400 to 1600, you can read Silvia Federici about this stuff. Educated, supposedly educated, supposedly knowledgeable, supposedly scientific men studying medicine took over the administration of medicine, as well as took over the role of the midwife, because they wanted to control population from women. And this science-y-ness, this educatedness, this expertness was part of the justification for the patriarchal takeover and the subsequent extreme disempowerment of women that happened in this period. But anyway, the major transition here happens in the 1700s, where there's a split, a divorce within philosophy. So previously, philosophy had meant everything that you could study rationally. And as a subset of this, we had the study of the natural world. So that was called natural philosophy. But in the 1700s, there's a split. And some scientifically minded people who have a real fetish for numbers and measurement, they split from the rest of philosophy. And this is basically a split about what truth is. And it still exists. You know, like, this is an old historical debate I'm sharing with you. But it's important to us because it still exists today. Because we still have ideas about what truth is and how you get truth and what kinds of experts or faculties are in possession of truth and in what degree that follow from this debate, right? We still tend to speak as if physics was real knowledge, whereas whatever they do in English is something different, right? That mathematics is real and solid, whereas philosophy, I bet a bunch of you have been led to believe, is like fluffy and squirmy and like a luxury or something. That divide between the so-called sciences, which are to be based upon observation and measurement, and which claim that they are value neutral, that they don't have anything to do with good or bad or politics, they separate themselves off from the rest of philosophy at this point. Notice also that claim that the hard sciences make, even to this day, which is that they are value neutral. First of all, I think if you really look at it, it's pretty hard to sustain, especially if you see physics serving corporations and the military, like, all the time. There are values in there, they're just not really reflecting on them, which is not a very knowledgeable, wise thing to do, in my opinion. But also, when you read Deloria and Wildcat, they'll say this idea that you can have knowledge without ethics, that you can know the world but not be involved in any way thinking about, like, what is right to do in the world, or what are your responsibilities with respect to the world. It's like, this is some hyper-violent Western colonial dominator stuff, as far as they're concerned. To us, it just looks normal because we've been brought up in it, right? But the point of looking at this history is to defamiliarize that context so that it starts to look weird and we start being able to ask the kinds of questions that Deloria and Wildcat ask. And, you know, the big question I want you to ask yourself is, how are we served by knowledge and learning being broken into so many, like, little subfields so that you can spend your entire life just learning about, I don't know, mathematics and the way that hard drives work? You know, like, you can do that and you'll be respected as, like, a knowledgeable person in the society, but you'll have no idea about what's a good way to live, what's a good society, how we got here, what's happening right now in the society as a whole. You can be totally ignorant about all these things, and yet in our society, spoken of as a person who's really knowledgeable, as a smart person. What the hell happens that makes that possible? What if breaking knowledge, breaking the world and the study of the world into all these different fields actually just prevents us ever getting a full picture? But people who want to act on the world have to have a full picture. It'll never be perfect, granted, but we need to make one. I tend to think that's what is meant by the term, like, political education, is trying to get that big picture, even though we're not supposed to, but the disciplines get in the way. So, okay, 1700s split between the sciences and the humanities and letters, right? And then we have, over the next 100 years, a further differentiation of these faculties into different disciplines. So within the humanities, or the arts and letters, now we've got literature from all these different places, philosophy, the classics, meaning the works of Greece and Rome, art, history, music and musicology, the study of languages. These are all supposed to be related somehow more to, like, you know, values and, like, human experience or empathy. They're good for making a rich life. You know, I've taught in this field my entire adult life, so I'm real familiar with how we're supposed to sell it to you, right? You know, the humanities are important to you because they will help you to live well. They will help you to understand what it is to be human and this kind of stuff. But what we're not saying is that we are rigorously measuring, testing, and predicting the world, which is what the sciences are claiming. So the sciences then break into disciplines with which I'm sure you're familiar: physics, chemistry, geology, astronomy, zoology, mathematics. Right. So we have all these different fields that you can study. And now it's weird that, like, you know, education or the generating of knowledge at this college level is supposed to be really, I don't know, I want to say like ghettoized, focused on one area only. I just don't get it. I've always been refusing. Like I as much as possible, I want to go study everything. But, you know, it's hard. Okay, and then we can add some stuff here. And what comes later, so now we're like up to the 19th century, in the middle of the 1800s, the time that the mainstream schooling starts, we also get the social sciences. So these are history. We already had history, but we're going to have a new version of history, economics, political science, and sociology. Now, let's recognize that the development of knowledge, you know, the development of the study of the world, the development of archives of documents purporting to say what is true, none of this stuff happens in a void, right? Even, you know, as much as like scholars and mathematicians and scientists like to pretend to be objective, there's no such thing as objective. There's no getting outside of particular circumstances, particular situations. And the particular situations in which this Western model of schooling develops is a colonial situation. So first of all, what countries is it that these social sciences, which are trying to be hard sciences and to really rely on measurement and observation and prediction, what are they really studying? Economics, political, economic studies, businesses and production and productive relations. Political science studies states and their decision making and their structures. Sociology studies civil society and the manner of its relations. What societies are they looking at? Well, they want to be really sciencey, right? So they want to base themselves upon existing documents. But where were these documents? They were in, primarily, Wallerstein tells us, five countries: France, Britain, the United States, Germany, and Italy. And so that's who these disciplines studied. Now, as a part of their attempting to get sciencey, they're also acting like the other members of the sciences act, and suggesting that what they're really looking for is universal laws. You want to find a rule that has no exceptions, right? You can expect that it will operate in any circumstance, but they only have these five countries' archives just to start with. So look at what grand, heroic, colonial assumptions they make, that like, okay, well, whatever we find in the archives of France, we're just going to say it's true for the whole world, because we're going to assume that there is a natural development that happens to every society, and the end point of it is France, Germany, the United States, Britain, and Italy. What grand assumptions, what non-scientific assumptions, right? So then you get those fields and their extreme biases. And then you get a couple of more, which are even more colonial. One is anthropology, because these countries that I listed were engaged in colonial domination of other places. And they set up anthropology as the study of the people they were dominating in places like Africa, in places like the Americas. And the preferred mode of investigation of anthropology would then be ethnography, participant research. You're going to take part in the society and you're going to write down what they do. And what you're trying to really do is figure out what they were like before the colonists showed up. Because here's another completely unsustainable, just hallucinatory set of assumptions, that these societies are so-called primitive, they're so-called savage, they're so-called barbarian, and they're alleged to be totally without history. So here's like sciences, so-called sciences, making the least reflective, most unscientific leaps, saying, now they don't have any history. We're the only ones who have history. It happened in England and France, this, and Germany, this history. These African people have always been the same. It's always been the same for them. They never had history. So if we can just figure out what they were like before we bumped them, then we'll know everything there is to know about them, and that's anthropology. But then there were some societies that were under colonial control that could not be called primitive or historyless because they had generated large archives and monumental structures and big hierarchical systems of control themselves, China and India in particular. So how's the West going to study these places? And notice the need to study through anthropology subjected populations, or in this case through Orientalism subjected populations, is not just like an academic intellectual need. It is a very practical and political and violent need. You need to know the population that you're controlling so that you know how to control them and to what to look out for in terms of rebellion. That's what you're really after. You want practical, actionable knowledge. So the last field here is one that you'll hear probably just as a racist term, and that is Orientalism. But I recommend, we study in my other classes, a book by Edward Said called Orientalism, and it'll give you the whole story there. Orientalism doesn't have to do with primarily the idea of like the word Oriental, which is just like an old school, now sounds very racist term that, like, you know, people who are now 100 might use that word to refer to Asian people, but that's not the meaning. And the Orient is not, first of all, China. It's all the Northern Africa, the whole Arab world, through the Middle East, through Central Asia, through India, and all the way to Japan, so including China. It's a huge territory, right? It's everywhere that there had been pre-existing structures that couldn't be called primitive. But what do the Orientalists do? They also study the societies and the literature about the societies, and they generate images of the people within these societies for the specific purposes of colonial administration. So here's the kind of gory and silly history of how we ended up where we're at. You know, like, you show up at the beginning of college and you're just like looking through these lists of subjects and you're like, oh my God, there's so many of them. What should I study? And then you're thinking, well, I'll just look it up, like which one makes the most money, right? But if you were like financially independent and if you had been educated differently, you might be thinking, well, what am I interested in? And even that is hard to answer, right? Because everything is so fragmented. And so maybe what this really ought to lead us to is a question, which is, what are the effects of knowledge being broken into these different parts and of there being a competition about where truth and knowledge can be found, and a suggestion that in a lot of ways of knowing, real truth can't be found, but in the place where real truth can be found, you can't say anything about what is right or wrong. Think about that. It's not just natural where we find ourselves. It's not just, it's always been like this. There was always, you know, cognitive science and computer science and Africana studies. By the way, you wanted to add something to this history. Africana studies, Chicano studies, women's studies, these ethnic studies, they're the result of struggle that happened in the middle of the 20th century. So the structure of the university now reflects not only the needs of the colonial administration, but also, to some extent, the needs of the subjugated population. Whenever you get more interesting, more pertinent education, you can expect that the bottom was operating there, that there was a push from the bottom up as well. But anyway, the main point of all this is just simply to say, look at that structure that you're in. Think about which subjects you've taken, what classes you've taken. Think about like the different assumptions that are made in those different fields, but also think about how those fields just ignore all the other fields as if they didn't matter, or as if like, okay, the experts over there will take care of this, I'm going to take care of this. But then who is it in society that actually knows what's real?